I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Kevin McKenna shows up today to tell us a little bit about his partnership at Louis Dresner McKenna, where he forged several things, including a wonderful Italian wine selection. Nice to see you, sir.
Nice to see you, too.
You started in restaurants.
So I was working in restaurants, and actually the first time I got the wine bug, I was working during college in summer at a resort up in on Lake Champlain in Vermont. It was sort of a cruise ship that never left land. very moneyed, old guard. And the crew came up in the summers from Boca Raton, from the Coral Gables, I think it were the Gables in Florida. And the first year I was there, the sommelier was a guy named Walid, who was Lebanese and went to the Sorbonne in France, and was really, really well-versed in wine. But what he liked to do most was play backgammon and smoke joints.
Oh, okay.
Bongs. So we hit it off really well.
Yeah, so you had some things to...
And he loved to talk about wine. And so I started to learn things from Walid with a small group of friends. We became more interested. I ended up working at a restaurant in Western Massachusetts, where I was in college, which was probably one of the best restaurants in the region. And they started promoting a wine program there, and I was just a waiter, but they started giving us seminars on wine, and I sort of got more and more interested in it. And so it was always something that I was very interested in. I worked in restaurants in New York, Manhattan Market, Windows on the World, which were high wine culture restaurants at the time.
What was the vibe like at Windows at that time?
The vibe at Windows was, well, you know, it was... very interesting. I mean, Kevin was in charge of the wine program. What's his name from the Wine Spectator was there at the time too. And Andrea.
Oh, okay. Andrea Amer.
Amer started there about the same time that I was there. And so it was an amazing, I mean, amazing seller at Windows on the World. And I could also go as an employee and have a big discount. So I'd go and with friends and order up some great old Chablis and do it up. It was great. So I got sort of burnt out on restaurants. I was doing other things and realizing I wasn't really making a living. I was spending all my money on doing my art. And so I traveled to Europe in 1987, and I went to a few wine places in Hungary and in Italy, and sort of loved it. I wanted to find a way to go back there, and so I...
Because it wasn't your primary reason for going.
No, it was not. It was, you know, to travel and to see and see friends who lived in Paris at the time. And
you've been doing some work in film.
Yes.
And that was kind of more of...
Yeah, I was more interested at the time in doing that. And so I came back, and I needed to find a job. I almost went back to Windows on the World in the wine program. But I decided to start working in the wine business from the ground up. And in those days, the wine business was really like still a guild. You started from the bottom, you apprenticed, you showed your stuff, and then you moved up. And from then on, I was in the right place at the right time. And
so Astor.
Yeah, I was at Morel's, then at Astor, where I took over the buyer's position in 89, and I was there till 93 in the buyer's position. That's when I met Joe and Denise.
Because that was pretty happening place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, at the time it was, largely through the previous buyer, Carol Zanoni, and me, we made a significant mark in the quality of the wines that were being presented at Astor at the time. And, you know, at the time there weren't all these amazing importers that there are now. There was just a handful. There was Robert Chatterton. Becky Wasserman was just starting. There really wasn't the mark of like a great importer. Neil Rosenthal was just starting. He still had his retail store up here in the Upper East Side. And
so it was like Kermit, Chatterton.
Yeah, Kermit wasn't even available on the East Coast.
Oh, on the East Coast.
Not even available on the East Coast. Nobody knew about Kermit out here until Michael Skarnik started his company.
So it was like...
In 1980, what year? 91 or thereabouts.
So it was like Chateau in the States kind of world.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Abdullah Simon was still, you know, much revered and a great importer. There started to be a blooming of small, independent, indie kind of importers, Joe Dresner being one of them, Victor Schwartz, a bunch of, and then Kermit was available here in the States, Neil Rosenthal. And so I met Joe and Denise just when they started their business. We were one of their first customers. Carol, the buyer before me, had placed an order with them, and then she left. Joe and Denise called me with an emergency meeting. They really wanted to meet me, and it turned out they were very, very worried that I was going to cancel
the order. Yeah.
And I said, rest assured, it's fine. I absolutely trust Carol's taste. And from then on, the wine came in, and I loved them and was really interested in working with them more closely.
So who were they bringing in at that time?
They were really had a set of wines from Burgundy
mostly, right.
And Mâcon. The Loire Valley didn't come till later, and I, you know, as soon as they started Loire Valley, I was one of the first to get on board with that. Marc Olivier's first vintage, I adored. I asked Joe if we could get some of his Gros Plante. He went back to Mark, and Mark was like, "Why does he want Gros Plante? I'm not selling him any Gros Plante."
Really?
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
and subsequently, he ripped up all his vines.
Oh.
But yeah, it was also the beginning of these country wines of France being more and more available. Up until that time, there was really no interest in wines from the Roussillon and wines from the Languedoc and wines from, you know, obscure appellations in the Loire Valley. And I think, you know, David Lilly and I were their biggest customers for Loire Valley wines.
And David was a Garnet at
the time. David was a Garnet at the time. And so I worked closely with Joe and Denise with what they were doing and, you know, asked them, you know, for certain things to find for me that I needed at Astor and that I wanted to have. And they were great. I mean, they were just really great. I ended up leaving there. I went to graduate school out of the country for a couple of years and came back. And Joe and Denise had really built their company to a point where they wanted to be more national importers. And so I helped them for a couple of years grow the market. We opened California and a few other states, which took a lot of work at the time because California was really a closed market. There was Kermit and Martine on the East Coast that really dominated any kind of import market.
On the West Coast,
I'm sorry.
And you lived in Rome in the interim, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So, okay.
I was doing a business degree in Rome and actually at the time went to see a bunch of wine producers, Jean Perrobert. That was back in, 1983.
Wow, kind of early days for 93. Him being instead of Paulo.
Yeah, he had just taken over from his dad, and I had bought the wines from Neil and loved them, absolutely adored them, and it was a great, great visit. His mom made, you know, the famous crostata that she made for any guest that came to the house. So I came back. I worked on a project with Astor for a while. On a freelance basis, John Osborne was the buyer at the time.
Was the Jeff Connell era at Astor?
Jeff Connell was after John Osborne.
And oh, okay.
It was about 98.
Got it. Okay. Thanks. I just never had that straight in my mind.
Yeah. Or maybe 2000, thereabouts. Yeah, maybe about 2000. Joe and Denise were looking for somebody to help them open up a larger market. We did, and then in 95 they wanted me to come on board full-time, and that's when we formed a partnership together, and we formed an even partnership in 96. So for all those years, I mean, we spent all our time in France, and that was Joe and Denise's comfort zone. They both spoke French.
They had a house
in the Mâcon where they spent the summer. I was always interested in Italian wines, especially, you know, Bea and obscure Italian wines. And great Nebbioli.
Interest develop.
You know, sorry?
Where did the interest in
Italian? At Astor at, yeah. at Morell's? Yeah, I was really in charge of the when I first started there. I was in charge of the Italian section. And Carol Zanoni was a great fan of Italian wines, and yeah. So and you know, Winebow with Peter Matt was at Winebow at the time, finding incredible Italian wines and bringing them in. And so it was really interesting to me because the diversity of the soil, the diversity of the grapes were you know, unparalleled, with other countries in terms of quality and diversity.
'Cause it seems like fairly quickly you kind of, went away from the Tuscan model, which was so popular,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of searched out more obscure mm-hmm. things. What in that search was important to you?
We always, you know, we did that in France. That we were always searching for sort of avant-garde or off the grid kind of wines and grapes that were really indicative of the place and of the grape, and had a purity of fruit and a purity of soil. So that was something that was already embedded in Joe, Denise, and I. The three of us had a very similar sort of taste profile. There were, you know, tweaks here and there, but we knew when we found a great wine that we had found a great wine. We all knew it. And so the same thing in Italy. I think it was more interesting for us to not battle the Sangiovese and the Nebbiolo market. It was better for us
because importers and more were interesting, yes. entrenched
and in more
those areas.
Interesting for us personally to find authentic grapes.
Because originally you didn't even want a Barolo, but then someone approached you.
Right, we didn't want. Originally, we didn't want to have a Barolo, but Baldo Capilano approached us, and we approached him, and we hit it off so well. He was a like-minded personality and perfect for us, and we loved the wines. And so, yeah, I mean, the model, also at the time, I think the market was saturated with Chiantis and Sangiovese-based wines and Super Tuscans, which were of no interest to us whatsoever. It also, finding these country wines were more the Vinaiolo kind of wines that we were looking for.
So what do you mean by Vinaiolo?
A Vinaiolo is, there's no word for that in real English or really even in French. It's it's somebody who works the soils, grows the grapes, makes the wine, does from beginning to end.
You know, we say winemaker,
right? But a combination of both,
yeah.
Because they're hands on, and you know, you can say paysan récoltant in French, but that's two words
you
put together.
You can
together.
Say that. I have trouble with that.
but that's really paysan is like saying contadino in Italian, which is peasant, which is mm-hmm. a country mm-hmm. bumpkin, but the Vinaiolo, the term is really, really specific in Italy, and it really represents somebody who does all the work. And so for us, it was much more fun to find these kind of people, and the wines were much more interesting. They tended not to do anything to the wines. They tended to work as cleanly as possible in the vineyards, to not do anything in the cellar, and to not use a major part of new oak, mainly because they couldn't afford these things. These things are expensive. Treatments, chemicals, fertilizers, new barrels, that's all a big expense.
That's an expense.
Yeah, and they had a small local market. You know, they were known in their particular region for having, you know, among the best of the regions.
How important is it when you search out that growers that they have a local following? Is that something you consider?
No.
So if they're making...
No, there's people I know. I mean, Eric Texier can't sell wine in France.
Right. Well,
claims,
that's a prime example.
Claims.
Yeah.
but no, it's not.
It's not a
intrinsic.
Consideration.
No.
So how did you go about developing the Italian portfolio for Dresner? Because it seems such like a great thing.
Right. We were approached in France at a famous wine tasting called the Dix Bouteilles, which happens in February, January, February every year in the Loire Valley.
So you were
Was
freezing
originally
when this happened.
was originally put together by Pierre Breton, who we
Okay.
worked with at the time. Pierre and Catherine were in charge of creating the Dix Bouteilles, and it started in Bourgogne. There was one lone Italian producer who was invited because she made Moscato d'Asti, which is a huge market in France. The French love Moscato d'Asti, and they were the best of the best Moscato makers. And Alessandra Bera approached us at one of these tastings and said, "You guys have to be working with me, and we have to work together." And she did that a couple of times. We were like, "No, we're not ready. We're not ready." Joe and Denise, it was totally outside of their comfort zone. They
They were used to
they didn't
France.
speak Italian. They didn't really know Italian wines. So ultimately, they liked Alessandra so much that we started working with Alessandra, and it was the beginning. Alessandra and her brother Gianluigi were really responsible for convincing Joe and Denise. I tried, but they really put it over the top with them. And so I organized a trip with the help of Alessandra in one January, and Joe, Denise, and I did a tour of Italy of great producers. And Denise and Joe fell in love with the land, with the people, with the grapes, with the food, with the culture, and realized it was an amazing opportunity because more and more we weren't able to, or we were in competition for the winemakers that we wanted to work with in
In
France.
France.
So for us to grow, it was a natural progression to work with these like-minded producers in Italy.
And what was the scene like? It seems like it's gotten started a little
Oh, at the
later.
time it was very, very small. Now, maybe there's 100 plus, but at the time there were
So
six or
now.
seven until the year that Vini Vary and Angelino Maule formed the show at Villa Favorita.
But compared to France, how many natural wine growers are there now compared to the
Oh,
100
France,
and
no, France is 200 to 300 natural wine producers
So there's
in the
quite a
country.
few more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Italy is much be more behind the times, but still growing quite a bit. And also, there's always been the producers who produced the way that they wanted to, but nobody knew that, there was no classification for
Sure.
that kind of winemakers, and so they got booted into this camp of natural wine producers. And so we found a number of producers, Stefano Bellotti at Cascina degli Olivi,
He seems sort of pivotal, kind of an early.
an amazing guy, a guy who started in the 80s using biodynamic viticulture in his vineyards and created a polyculture farm. Which was it was an amazing and continues to be really at the forefront of biodynamics and responsible culture in the vineyards. He's really in charge of the Joly School of Biodynamics in Italy. Now he's the linchpin in Italy for biodynamics. And Nadia Varua, Cascina Tavin, who was just starting, I think it was her first or second vintage. Angelino Male, who had a horrible experience in the United States and vowed he wasn't going to sell to the United States anymore, and we convinced him otherwise. Same thing with Stanco Radicone. Joe and I went back for Vinitaly, especially for the show, the Villa Favorita show that Angelino Male organized, and we met a number of other producers through Angelino and Stanco Radicone.
'Cause I remember you taking on like Masovecchia and the portfolio really kind of growing in a fairly short period of
In a
time.
short period of time, these were, wines that had been, there are a few that had been in the United States. They'd been here with Matthew Fioretti at Sumavitas on the West Coast and available here in New York. Things didn't go so well. So a number of those producers were wanting to do something different in the US. But it wasn't solely just, picking up the dregs of a Suma Vida's portfolio. It
Doesn't
was
feel
not
like
that
it at
set. Yeah,
all.
yeah. We found other producers that were
Right.
really
Quite a few,
outside
like
of the mark.
Acapinti, for
It's
example.
like Ariano Capinti, who's that was her second vintage. We were completely enamored of the wines and thought they were terrific. Who else? Silvio Massana, Monte Secondo,
Oh,
who's a
sure.
friend of mine from New York, who moved back to Italy, took on a farm, started making wine, and really is making really exceptional wines in Tuscany.
And you've continued to bring out some things from the like Valpolicella area
The
of
Valpolicella.
Verona, and you brought in a new producer in the Vino Nobile area that was quite good, Podere Sangiannetto.
And Heinrich and Nusserhof.
Oh, those ones are good.
Yeah. Yeah, Heinrich was one of the first people that we worked with. That was an amazing find. Really incredible. And always one of my favorite. I had been to Bolzano in Italy, gone to see Alice Legater a long time ago. And was really enamored of the wines and we really like the three of us really like the mountain grapes of
Sure.
Italy. They really hit a sweet spot with us, and so that was a perfect fit for us.
Somebody else that is in the north, Radicon, has done a lot of work with skin maceration, kind of famous for that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that works out?
Sure. Well, there's the what's called the Slovenian Mafia. They're all on this one road outside of Gorizia, which is on the border of Slovenia. And at the time, Slovenia was cut off from the Europe up until just a few years ago. And there was this one road leading from Gorizia through Oslavia, which led into Slovenia. And these people all had Slovenian roots. They'd gone back and forth between Italy and Austria and Slovenia after World War I. But they all had like-minded kind of philosophy. They all wanted to make wines that they remembered their grandparents making and the way that grandparents make. So across the street is Jasko Grosvenor, and there's a number of other producers there. Dario Princic, really, who all had a like mind to create these wines the way that they remembered wines being. And so part of that was to do skin maceration. The reason being, the idea being that through the skin maceration of white wines, treating white wines as if they were vinifying them as if they were red grapes,
Because that's the technique we would
that's
use for
basically
all
the
red wines.
It's basically the same technique you would use for red grapes. Allows you to use less sulfur because you're extracting antioxidants
I didn't
from the
realize
grapes.
that
Yes.
part of it.
And the reason why the Radicon do 3 years is because they did a number of different experiments of time on the skins
On the skins of the
to see,
maceration.
and with testing to see what the antioxidant levels were in the wines, and they found that the 3 year period was the period that really gave stability to the wine.
But more recently, they introduced something that was
Yeah,
macerated for less time, right?
they've done some wines that are macerated for less time. Those are quaffable wines that are supposed to be drank early. These
Like
aren't.
less
These
tannic.
yes, less tannic and need less time to develop, and are not really meant to last as long.
Understood.
Unlike Grosvenor, who gravitated towards making wine the way the ancients did.
Okay.
Which was starting to use amphora,
Okay, like clay.
yeah, clay pots like the Greeks and the Romans used. Radicon wanted to firmly stay within his family history, and the family history was always using very large Slavonian oak barrels. Sorry,
Okay.
big difference between Slovenia and
I get it mixed up all the time.
Slavonia. Yeah, and so that was his method, and he's not really interested in using amphora.
But you do have producers in the stable who use a little clay
Yeah,
sometimes.
we do. It's crazy. I think we have a number of producers who are using or starting to use amphora. We work with Elisabetta Foradori, who has moved all of her single vineyard wines to amphora that she buys in Spain. We work with Cristiano Cutarolo, who's in Puglia, who uses clay that he gets from Daruda, but he's trying to buy wine, clay pots from Georgia. We work with Cantina Giardino in Campania. All their clay pots are handmade by Daniela, who's the wife of the winemaker. She has a degree in pottery, and
Oh, I didn't know that.
she creates all the amphora that they use for their vinifications. Who else?
Does Panavino use clay
No,
sometimes? No.
never.
Okay. So it's orange, but
It's
not
all barrel.
amphora.
Yes. And who else? Silvio Massana at Montesecondo is doing Sangiovese. We're releasing his Sangiovese in amphora this year, which is
I did not
awesome.
know that.
Which is awesome. And yeah, it's an interesting idea. We're Domenico Vette, who uses the concrete egg, which is really
I'm a big fan.
this really a facsimile of a amphora use.
Sure.
What you get is, these whole grapes in an amphora clay pot sealed, and the grapes just start fermenting within the grape and start extracting from within. There's a constant movement in the amphora because of the shape of the amphora, so you don't have to. At a certain point, you do punch down, but at a certain point, you close it, and it's a constant
It's
remoulage.
intercellular, and it doesn't.
It's intercellular, and it's also in a movement. It's also a constant remoulage.
I did not realize that. So you don't have to like stir it up. It does its own thing.
Right.
What do you think some of the characteristics in the glass of an amphora wine that we could glean from those versus some of the more conventionally made wines?
Well, obviously they're not going to be as clear.
Yeah. Not quite as white. Yeah.
Not quite as limpid as
Mm-hmm.
they say. There's going to be a deepness of color, whether white or red. But what I find is really interesting in some of the amphora wines is that there is a wholeness to the flavor and a brightness, a freshness of the fruit, that's unlike anything that you can get in, especially in stainless steel, but also in even old neutral big barrels.
Because it's kind of like that completeness that happens with old wine that's aged a long time in the cellar, but it's brought it forward in a way. Sometimes I feel like there's
Yeah,
a.
they're always plush and forward too. They're always accessible.
Right.
You never find that they're the tannins are always rounded. And they're extremely drinkable wines.
What do you tend to pair them up with at the table if you're opening up something that's been aged in clay? Let's say, for instance, it
Oh,
started with white grapes in this
yeah, I don't
instance.
know. I think I'm a firm believer in keeping food as simple as possible and as fresh as possible. And I think that's if you match, basically, you can match anything if the quality of your ingredients matches the quality of the ingredients of the wine.
Fair
Big,
enough.
big fan of uncomplicated food.
So you just broached into Germany. Speaking of kind of pioneering new areas for the company, what's that been like?
It was a real revelation for us. We were approached by an estate in Pfalz. They wanted to have a national importer. It's people that we knew well, and I was. Well, I don't really think that's gonna ever be a possibility. At the same time, we were approached by another group whose importation had sort of fallen apart here in the United States. And Denise and I did a big tasting with the wines, and Maya Peterson, who works for us also, was there, and we tasted the wines, and we found them revelatory in flavor profile for German wines, something that, Joe never really cared at all for German wines. But he did care for this one producer that Clemens Busch that we will start working with. He thought the wines
Who's
were
no
interesting.
notable for using low sulfur?
Who's notable for using low sulfur and doing dry fermentations. So you're not stopping the fermentations by a dose of sulfur to keep the sweetness. So we tasted through a number of these dry Rieslings, and both Denise and I said, these are these are amazing wines, and it's obvious the winemakers are very serious. We would be, you know, happy to represent any of them. And so quickly, myself and Jules Dresner, Joe and Denise's son, who works with us now, and Josefa Concannon, who is our national sales rep based in Chicago, did a quick trip to Moselle to go visit these producers, and it was revelatory. It's an amazing soil with amazing, hard-working winemakers, and these winemakers are really producing something that's very, very outside the norm in Germany and in the Mosel and Pfalz.
So who are some of the people you're going to be bringing?
We'll be working with Clemens Busch, Clemens and Rita Busch, which I'm thrilled about. I think the wines are really amazing. We'll be working with Gernot Coleman, who's taken over the historic estate of Emich Batterieberg.
I really love the wines he's turning out these days. I think they're way underappreciated.
He's really, I tend to relate these people to people that I know. He's the Texier of
he is.
Of the Moselle, I think. He's really a really talented individual who's sincerely making, you know, an overused term, Burgundian Rieslings, which is really, really interesting. And the soils are really fantastic. His vineyards are really, really fantastic. And Matthias Knebel up in the Mosel Terrassen, Terrassen Mosel. And he's a young guy who's taken over his family's estate. Gernot was a consultant for a few years, and since 2008, Matthias has been making all the wines. They're really clear and precise, and really beautiful expressions. And they have again some amazing, amazing vineyards that are practically perpendicular. I mean,
so when are we going to start seeing those wines come into the States?
Well, hopefully, there's a pending possibility of a dock strike here on the East Coast. We're trying to get the wines on board, picked
they
up
could have
right
been a
now,
contender,
right
you know?
Now, so that dock they get strike. Here before October 1st. So we're really hoping they'll be here before October.
Cool. So I think a lot of times people now associate the company, Louis Dresner, kind of so much with natural wine. But how did it get to that point? Because you said that, you know, Joe originally was working a lot with Burgundy.
We've always had trouble with the idea of being the natural wine importer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the standard bearer. Because I remember you guys did the
what
thing.
What we started with, when Joe, Denise and I started the company, when Joe and I started working together, we came with a consensus that was basically Joe's through tasting a number of the estates that he'd worked with at the time, that the wines that we really liked were all shared a commonality. And there were two fundamentals: that they were hand harvested, that they weren't machine harvested, and that they were vinified using only their indigenous yeast. And we decided to only work with wines that were made this way. And that was our precept from the beginning. That's still our precept now. Because of that, it coincided that a lot of producers were finding themselves in the natural wine. It led us to work with people who were working organically, because in order to vinify using the natural yeast, you have to do good work in the vineyards. It's impossible if you're treating and killing your culture in the vineyards to get a full fermentation in the cellar. So it led us to work with people working in organic, and then the biodynamic movement really started burgeoning. Catherine and Pierre Breton, some of the first in France, in the Loire Valley, to be biodynamic in the vineyards. So it led us into this group of natural winemakers. And subsequently, yes, we work with a lot of producers who identify themselves with the natural wine movement, but we also work with a lot of producers who do not ally themselves with this. It's a polemic.
So a little bit about the polemic side. I mean, sometimes I feel like you guys are, taken to the stake sometimes by writers, or maybe certain producers that you work with are. One thing I find a little troubling is that how frequently words like jihadi or, I don't know, like
fanatic.
Yeah, fanatic, sort of
fanatical. Yes, fanatical
around.
Winemakers. I've yet to meet a fanatical winemaker. I'm really hoping someday to meet a fanatic.
Keep it up.
Mark Angeli comes pretty close, but I, you know, you would not find his picture in the Webster's definition of a fanatic. He's more of an isolationist and a really true believer in what he does.
Uh-huh.
So yes, it's sort of this.
Are we uncomfortable as a culture with people who really believe in what they're doing?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's it's so much easier to turn the tables and say that, you know, they're extremists.
Because they have a point of view.
Yes.
That they assert.
That they assert and confront with.
Is it against...
And perhaps maybe at the beginning, a lot of them swung the pendulum a little bit far.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But who knew how far you could go until you went there, right?
In true Hegelian dialect, it's all coming back to a real...
You're the guy who understands Hegel that I always wanted to talk to. I never got it.
So, what was I saying?
But I mean, is it against the idea of luxury marketing of wine, lifestyle wine, to have an idea of, oh, I really believe in this? Are those two things that we saw kind of wine become?
I don't know. You know, I could say I could say Angelo Gaia is like a fanatic in some respects for wanting to use new oak. You could say, you know, I have eminent respect for Bobby Katcher, but you could say Bobby Katcher's a fanatic for only making people only use new barrels.
Mm-hmm. So why last time around were those guys given the high five, and now you guys are given
fermenters, etc., and Roto fermenters in
Piedmont?
You guys
are given the stink eye. Why? What's the difference?
I think I don't know. I think it's a certain close-mindedness that we're experiencing on not just in the wine industry, but throughout,
as a country,
and as a culture.
Are people who are not used to the flavors of these wines, do you find that they easily gravitate towards them, or is there sometimes some resistance to the kind of difference? Or
it depends. It depends on the wine. It depends how much in your face the wine is. There's certain wines that, you know, I believe will never be a popular taste,
but they're
still
so
fascinating,
and
to the people who really can see that, the wines are a fascinating example of analogy.
Do you think it's somewhat easier then to understand some of these wines if people don't have the background of conventional wines?
I think yes. Our biggest market and the rise in our market when we started, and we started talking about natural yeasts and hand harvesting, you know, people were like, "Who cares? Who cares? What does the wine taste like?
Right.
Or what's your points? You know.
Right. What were the points scores?
Yeah. And so it was difficult. We had you know, a whole set of lazy distributors, lazy retailers who sold wines on points. You know, the points came out in Parker and they sold all their, you know, Spanish wine for that day, that their incomplete portfolio. They sold it up only because of the points. And that's how the retailers bought. That's how, not so much restaurants, but retailers tended to buy, you know, a lot more sometimes than restaurants. And, so it became this culture of, you know, wine spectator, wine advocate, tans are not so much, but still very, very influential. And you had a new generation within the past 12 years or so who never had that culture, because the wines that the wine advocate talked about, the wines that the wine spectator talked about, reached a price level that was completely out of any normal person's pocketbook. And so these wines weren't of interest to them because they couldn't afford to drink them. And it was more of looking at wines that were affordable, which we tend to have a lot of, and that that really spoke of purity, that really presented a profile of what I like to think is more alive in your mouth. You know, an overworked wine always, to me, tastes dead. It just sits in your mouth, and you really can't drink more than a glass of it if forced. And an alive wine just is bright and keeps you coming back to the glass and keeps you coming back to your food and keeps you coming back to the glass. And so this whole new generation are not influenced by, you know, Parker. They're not influenced by the Wine Spectator so much anymore. And, you know, our big success is among the people who really open their eyes and open their palate and really take a look at the wines in a more holistic and less critical, less breakdown, you know, the flavor profile, breakdown the beginning, middle, and end of the wine, and really look at the holistic aspect of the wine and how it tastes in your mouth and what kind of impression it gives.
So as maybe the sommelier age in New York has gotten younger, have you seen a growth in sales?
Yeah, as the wine director age level gets younger, we see a little bit more interest in these wines as long as they have a public to support it. And, you know, I've seen people try and fail in lots of markets.
Criticized widely.
And when we really started, I mean, the market for these kind of wines was really concentrated in New York.
Red Hook 360.
Well, yeah, even like at 360.
Yeah.
And Chamber Street Wines. But
like at one restaurant and one retailer. Right.
But slowly throughout the country, you had small pockets of the resistance, which I like to term. And
Princess Leia is one of my favorite sommeliers. Absolutely. She's so gracious at the table.
Yeah. Especially when she wears her hair up instead of on the side.
Well, she can't hear when she wears it on the side. No, but you talked a little bit about wine being alive in the mouth. One of the things that I think of is really kind of bright and, I mean, really it is bubbly, is Pet Nat. That's something that seems somewhat alive. But I think it's a category that maybe takes some explaining.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting success. That was a sort of winemaking that could have been lost, I think. It certainly was widespread throughout Europe. It is to explain Pet Nat or Méthode Ancestrale or Metodo, you'd say Refermentazione Ancestrale in Italy, is really the old way of keeping wine pre-sulfur. The difference between it and a Metodo Classico is that Metodo Classico or Champagne, Méthode Champenoise, is a second fermentation. There's two fermentations. Pet Nat is the primary fermentation and in bottle. So at the time when people didn't have, I mean, the rise of sulfur wasn't until the end of the 19th century. Shortly after phylloxera, people tried to use sulfur against the phylloxera. And up until that time, people made, especially in the countryside, made wines like this, bottled with a little bit of the sugar. The fermentation happened in the bottle. It created natural carbon dioxide, and the wines lasted. But they would always have a pétillance to them. And so, you know, there were only a few areas of the world where through the wine industrial age, the post-war wine industrial age, where that kind of method really, really held up. One of those places is Emilia-Romagna, which it's always been the culture and continues to be the culture there for making wines that are Frizzante or Frizzantino.
So we would think about Lambrusco. Mm-hmm.
About Lambrusco, which was practically destroyed by Rioniti and Chilicella in the 70s. But luckily there were some, you know, stalwart winemakers. I remember going to Bologna and Emilia Romagna in the 80s and not being able to find I found one dry Lambrusco, one producer who made a dry Lambrusco sparkling.
Was that Graziano?
Everything else was Amabile because they were following the fashion of Rioniti, and so this dry kind of Lambrusco almost was gone.
Ceased to exist almost.
Luckily, it was revived. The Pet Nat culture in Loire Valley was really the responsibility of one guy, Christian Chaussard, at Domaine Le Brissot. Now at Domaine Le Brissot, who was working in Vouvray at the time, and revived Pat Nat. He was teaching. He teaches oenology. Yeah, he teaches oenology at somewhere in the Loire Valley. I forget. I think it's in Amboise or somewhere. And at the time, researched this method and was really one of the first to start making these Pat Nats. And you know, subsequently, Terry Pouzelah really championed the idea of making these wines also. And then also, of course, in Cerdon de Bugey, in the Bugey region, you had people at one point, there was a distinct division of those who made Méthode Ancestrale and those who made Charmat method of Cerdon. And you could only use the Méthode Ancestrale labeling if you use this primary fermentation in bottle. I think they're inherently interesting wines and extremely drinkable.
If it all turned out the way that you want it to turn out, and the landscape in America were to alter for wine, and we're looking at 15, 20, 25 years down the road, what does that America look like in terms of what it's drinking and what the
Oh, I
attitude
don't really
towards
want
wine
it to
is?
change all that much. Our producers don't make that much wine.
Sure.
And in order to be able to work this way, they can't have that much land. The ideal, you know, the maximum I think is 11 to 14 hectares.
So it's
It's
supposed to be
really like the
niche.
most. Yeah. I think it will always be. I think it will always be niche
Because there's
down the
not a way
road.
to
I
really
think
commercialize it
there really
that
isn't, and
way.
if it gets commercialized, it'll get co-opted by industrial winemakers, and that's the real danger, I think, down the road. And I don't know. Legislation's always a dangerous, slippery slope, and I think ideas of labeling and certification, etc. It's a very, very slippery slope. Especially in this country where our wine labeling is run by the Bureau of Firearms, and really can't coordinate anything with the Department of Agriculture. I would hope it's not going to change that much. I'd like a little bit more understanding what's so wrong with peace, love, and maybe a wider throw, more comprehension that wine is a food product, just the way we look at cheeses, the way we look at produce that we buy at the farmers market, that we look at wine with that kind of eye, that kind of experience, because I think there's a real disconnect. It's getting better, but I think for many years there's a real disconnect between wine and from whence it comes.
One of the
So.
things you said once was that you didn't think that it was necessary to run a company where you liked everyone you worked with, but what was the fun in not doing that? Like you really wanted to like the people you were working with. Is that something that still has
Oh yeah,
maintained?
that's a real big.
Because it seems like the
I remember going around Joe tasting, and we'd go visit people or like some of these wine shows. And sort of like the wine, but Joe would go, "Look at that guy. You really want to work with that guy?" He was
Because there's a level
a
where Dresden
little shallow
producers party
sometimes.
together. You
Yes,
know what I mean?
but yeah, we like working with people who are like-minded. I mean, it's not a deal breaker, but it's real, really important to us. And subsequently, and we've created like a family of winemakers who are much more interconnected than they would be if they hadn't been working with us
Do you
or they
think
hadn't
there's
met
been
us.
a cross-pollination?
I think there's been an amazing, for me, one of the greatest things that our company has been able to do is create this cross dialogue, especially between Italy and France, where for a lot the French are chauvinists and the Italians are jealous and petty sometimes. Not all the time. But we've created this sort of understanding and rapport between winemakers in different parts of Europe that didn't really exist before. It was it's really heartening for me to see, you know, the reason Ariana's wines are the way they are is because she knew Marcel LaPierre and Terry Puzlo. You know, it, also she had a basis of working, you know, with her uncle, Giusto Acapinti, of course, and also very good friends with Frank Conalisa in Etna. And, you know, her wines wouldn't be as really compelling if she hadn't had this experience. There's a number of different producers. Eric Texier goes to visit people in Italy all the time to see what they're doing. Even Jean-Paul Brun from Terre de Ray, who's, you know, probably one of the epitome of a French vigneron, an incredible French vigneron, but is his eyes are so much more open to winemaking in other cultures and having a rapport with people in other parts of the world. You know, I think really what's important for us is to work with winemakers who are always questioning, always trying to make their wines better, always thinking about it. And I think we happen to represent a lot of, I mean, almost all of our producers are constantly thinking about their techniques or researching other important parts of either viticulture or winemaking in the cellar. They're always striving for something better. And that has tended to cross cultural lines now too, where people are discussing between themselves, you know, because for what works in Chianti may not work in the Beaujolais because of soil climate, microclimate, etc. And you're dealing with, you know, different kinds of humidity, etc. And but there's a real cross interest in understanding what each other are doing, and it's really, really heartening to see.
One of the things I saw Dresden do really early, and that is still more talked about than emulated, is the idea of bringing all the growers to the tasting for the trade. So you would see 20, 30 growers pouring at the table, meeting with the buyers in New York, which is not the normal.
Right.
And now we hear so much about, well, the grower, but it felt like when I first started my career, we didn't. Do you think that there has been a change partly because of that?
I mean, it was always fundamental for us that the grower was first, the winemaker was first, and getting to know these winemakers either through their wines or personally was of ultimate importance. And so with that in mind, we started bringing over as many producers as we could. The producers loved it because they, you know, got a week off to party in the United States and to meet their customers. And it, you know, the great thing, I remember when Françoise Tête, the wife of Michel Tête and Julianas, they came for the first time. You know, it was a time when Beaujolais was going through a really tough period. It was hard to sell, and they had a couple of really horrible, hard vintages. And they came here, and the wines were so appreciated. And the people who tasted them told them so and really talked to them. It was reinvigorating to them. It changed the way that they look at their wines. It changed the way that they felt about what they were doing. I've seen it happen with, you know, children of winemakers who think, you know, oh, my dad's a, you know, plouc. He makes wine and you know, I never want to do that. I'm going to do something else. Who come with them here and see how appreciated and how much heroes like Marc Olivier, for instance, how incredibly treated they are here and revered. And they have a whole different idea of what their father's been doing these last 15 years when he's working so hard in the vineyards and working so hard in the cellar and breaking his back and they don't have any money. And it changes the way that they perceive the whole idea of their father's or the parent, the father or mother's work. And what it means.
Do you think that some of them have stayed in the wine business as a result, whereas they may have left?
Yeah, I know of a few instances where kids really wanted nothing to do with their parents' business, and their minds have changed as a result of traveling with their parents and seeing the reception and what the job entails and what a great culture it is to have this kind of conversation with your customer and to be respected in such a way for doing hard, menial work.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I can go back to my crossword puzzle now.
All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.